Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to the Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast. I'm your host, John Lasswolf. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
I had one of the most amazing discoveries ever couple days ago.
All right.
Yeah, you want to hear about it?
Please.
All right, so I'm watching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, right? And at the end, there's a scene in a hospital, and it's Val Kilmer, Robert Downey Jr. They're in a room. And a bunch of people who died earlier in the film comes back, and then all of a sudden Abraham Lincoln walks back, and then Elvis Presley walks in. So if you remember from our Kurt Cella pod, I was talking about Kurt Russell and how like Elvis, you know, how he's crossed paths with Elvis many times in his career. But I forgot I said that Val Kilmer was Elvis in True Romance, but I totally forgot that Val Kilmer was with the fake Elvis in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. So I failed.
Oh man.
Yeah,
that whole Kurt Cella podcast is kind of void now.
Yeah, it's terrible. And yeah. You know what else? He played Iceman in Top Gun. There's also an Iceman in the X-Men movies.
Oh,
Sean Hennessy, right?
Yeah.
But he's with Kevin Bacon in The Following, right?
Yeah.
And Kevin Bacon is in. Let's see. Kevin Bacon is with. Who are we going to go with? Brad Pitt in Sleepers, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So Brad Pitt was with, let's see, who are we going to go? Brad Pitt was with George Clooney, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Who was in Batman and Robin, yeah?
Yeah.
And guess who else was Batman?
Who?
Val Kilmer.
Oh. Oh, man.
I don't know what that means, but.
I think you just blew my mind.
I just heard a pop behind me. I think my neighbor's head just exploded.
Yeah. I think I'm about to go through the same thing.
Keep it together.
Oh man. No, I gotta get through this podcast. All right. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
All right.
That was close. I saw your head just like.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise.
I was about to go what's your name from The Exorcist?
You're about to go, oh gosh, Linda Blair?
Yeah, Linda Blair. I wanted to say Linda Hamilton. Like, no, she's from Terminator.
You were about to go Wafer Thin Mint from Monty Python?
Yes. Exactly.
Was it Scanners when the head explodes?
Oh, I think, yeah, it was Scanners.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
We should do a podcast about best head explosions.
No, Kingsman? That would be a long one, actually.
Yeah.
And, actually, John Levigood, our usual co-host, is actually out of town this week.
Yeah.
Apparently, he's eating his way through all of Northeast America.
Yeah.
He's posting all of his gastronomic adventures on Facebook at the moment, and he's basically just, I feel like he's gaining like 5-10 pounds for every picture he posts.
Yeah. And I think it was like the other day at like 11 a.m. and he posted like, here's my deep dish, triple large, extra large, yeah. Every kind of meat pizza yeah. at like 11 a.m. that he was eating.
Yeah, apparently he's on a work trip, but I don't know. Is eating like his job? I think that's all he's doing.
Yeah. I think it's an air quotes
okay.
work trip.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like food adventures are the best adventures, to be honest.
What's your best food adventure?
I mentioned earlier when I ordered all the appetizers from Applebee's.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. That was quite the adventure. There were highs, there were lows. A lot of lows.
Weren't you in bed for 3 days?
It felt like it. Well, I was in the bathroom for 3 days.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, I think it's time to start the podcast like we usually do with listener questions. Mark, I'm assuming you have listener questions this week?
I do. I'm not going to do John Levingood's voice and fake that. It will sound like, you know what? If I attempt John Levingood, I might actually do Michael Caine.
Do a John Levingood impression, Mark.
Oh, gosh. Hey, guys. John Levingood here.
No,
I don't got it.
I'm not feeling it.
I think that's the closest I've ever gotten to a Michael Caine impersonation, though. My first question comes from Sarah Lockwood, and it says, in the realm of awful movies, what draws the line between a cult classic terrible movie and just a painfully bad, I wasted my money watching this piece of shit movie? So for me, I think all of the terrible, bad cult classics were made by somebody thinking they were making a great film.
Okay.
So you have The Room. Tommy Wiseau thought he was making a great job, you know, doing a great job. You have Birdemic. You have Troll 2. You have Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li.
Yeah.
Like, I think these people thought they were making good films.
Oh, you know Chris Klein thought he was going to win an Oscar for his portrayal of Nash.
Yeah, at least a Golden Globe, you know. And I think where it goes wrong, where it's like the awful, you know, I just wasted my money, is when, like, think about movies like Snakes on a Plane, right? Mm-hmm. Where it wanted to be a cult classic. It tried to be a cult classic. It desperately wanted to be a cult classic, and it was nowhere near a cult classic. Yeah. To be a terrible cult classic film, and we're not talking about, like, Boondock Saints, stuff like that. We're talking the really bad ones, you know, so bad they're good. You have to make it. Attempt to make it good.
Right.
Because it's a very earnest failure then, and it's very enduring. Like, it's not like Sharknado 3 or like, you know, Honey Badger versus, I don't know, Honey Badger.
Yeah. So I definitely agree with you here. The audience is smarter than, you know, people think. You know, if you go out and intentionally, you know, try to, like, make, like, a cult classic movie, like, I think it's obvious to anybody watching a movie. Like, there's no genuine intent to make, like, you know, an entertaining movie. I think you're right, you know, for something like The Room. Like, they really thought they were making, like, you know, the greatest movie ever made, and it didn't really turn out that way. So, yeah. But I think the audience can kind of feel the earnestness of the filmmakers, you know, throughout the movie. When you have, like, something soulless, like Snakes on a Plane was... Like, it just felt, like, too commercial. It just didn't... You didn't feel like, you know, they were genuinely, you know, happy to make the movie. They were just in it for the paycheck. Whereas, like, The Room, it's like, you could tell, like, you know, they're giving it all. They're all. And it's just, like, for some reason, that just... It's easier to kind of relate to that, you know?
Yeah, and I read The Disaster Artist, written by Greg Sestero. It was about the making of The Room.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Wiseau spent millions of dollars on this movie, right? And he uses green screen to make, you know, the San Francisco skyline. But it turns out he owned a building in San Francisco, and they could have shot on the roof there. But he just wanted to, like, play, you know, a big game and show Hollywood he could beat them at their own game. So he spent, like, you know, $1 million extra, got a studio, bought all of his own equipment when he didn't have to, because he wanted to be like, hey, I'm Hollywood too.
Yeah. that's actually amazing.
Yeah. Like, they're making that movie directed by James Franco. I wonder if they're going to try to make it good.
You know, I hope it is. It's just Franco's really hit or miss these days.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, because what's it? The Interview? Like, it just, that felt a little flat, a little bit.
I loved it when he was dealing with that bag and thought the swag was all wrong.
Yeah.
I had a good time watching it.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. Like, he either takes a massive swing or he doesn't swing at all.
I'm glad, like, he swings for defenses.
He doesn't hit singles. Like, he'll strike out or he'll swing.
Yeah.
Or he'll just not even make it there.
Yeah. So I guess, like, another thing I want to add to that question is that basically if I were just simplified it down to, I would just, if I had to simplify it down to one thing, it would just be, did I have fun watching this movie? That's really, like, the only, you know, thing, the only criteria it needs to meet. Like, did I have fun watching, like, this really bad movie? And, you know, for movies like The Room, you know, Idle Hands, my favorite.
Yeah,
bad movie,
you love though. That movie.
Yeah. And also the Evil Dead movies. Like, they're not, like, you know, they're not Oscar winners, but you have a lot of fun watching those movies. Snakes on a Plane, I did not have fun watching. I know this isn't supposed to be a cult classic, but Jupiter Ascending, I did not have fun watching that movie.
Oh, dude, I love that movie.
Really?
I think it's terrible, but I love it.
Oh.
Hey, was I with you when we were watching Ultraviolet? And I think I laughed like really loud about 10 minutes in. Then everybody in the it was a packed theater. Then everybody in the audience was like, "Oh, hey, this movie's kind of funny." Was I with you?
See, the thing is, like, I feel like that happened like with us like more than a couple times.
Oh yeah, you're right.
So
you're
right. I don't know, like, if that was old. It could have been Ultraviolet, or it could have been like one of the million other movies we saw together.
Yeah. Guys, I think this sounds crazy, but I think it's on Crackle right now. But Ultraviolet, it's a Mila Jovovich film that's horrible. But like, if you watch it with a group of people and just embrace the stupidity, you're going to have a great time watching it.
Yeah. It's I don't know. It was kind of a disappointment for me because the filmmaker, he made Equilibrium in his previous movie. And I love that movie. So,
I don't know. Yeah. Sean Bean eats it pretty good.
Although I will say that out of all the movies we watched together, I think Street Fighter was the only movie that you actually fell asleep during The Legend of Chun-Li.
But I love that movie. I didn't fall asleep because it was bad. I fell asleep because, you know, all the Coors Lights.
Yeah, we downed like a ton of Coors Lights before we saw that movie.
So it wasn't like me just going like, "I'm not interested." It was just like, I literally can't stay awake.
So I think it was like halfway through the movie, I look over and you're just kind of nodding off.
That's, you know, I regret it too, man.
Yeah. Well, you didn't really miss much, to be honest.
I mean, I own it anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah. Okay, so I think the answer to that question is Mark nodded off during Street Fighter. Legend of Chun-Li.
Wait, if I fall asleep and end up watching it later, you know it's a good cult classic.
Yeah, I think you redeemed it. You watched it later. You just had like a Coors Light nap.
Yeah, that's right. I napped the Rockies?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. All right, so the second question is from my buddy Josh. And this is kind of funny, this question he asked, because you can tell this from like a very, not a film nerd, but like a guy that knows film, because he wrote, "What do you think Daniel Plainview did after he beat Paul to death with a bowling pin and said, 'I'm finished'?" So the setup in this scene is from There Will Be Blood with Daniel Day-Lewis. And he starts the movie alone, makes a fortune. There's all these people in his life. Then slowly he gets them all out of his life. And at the very end, Paul Dano, this character, Paul, I think that's his name, but mm-hmm. he basically beats him to death with a bowling pin. And after the final shot is Daniel Plainview going, "I'm finished." So basically everybody that was in his life is now out. So now he has this massive mansion all to himself, you know, like, you know, he can, it's like the last man on earth, not really, but just in his mansion. So, I mean, I think he's going to make a milkshake, right? And then he's going to finish the game of bowling he was doing. Like back in the day, setting up all those bowling pins was tough. Like, you don't just set it up and leave. Like, oh, yeah. I'm bowling.
Well, you have to walk back and forth, like pick up the pins and all that.
Yeah, it's a commitment. Like, what if he's halfway through? So I think he finished bowling, then drank a milkshake and laughed to himself for about an hour, and then drank himself to death.
See, I think, because I thought the question like referred to what he immediately did after that beatdown. This is my interpretation. I feel like he just went back to the counter, returned his bowling shoes, and just went home.
He was home.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But maybe he had a petrified person working behind the booth.
Yeah.
Like, imagine being the guys that work for him.
Yeah. You know, I can just, I think we've all been there. You know, we've had, like, a bad game of bowling. It just wasn't, you know, your night. You were hitting, like, gutter balls, like, for every other game. I'm just like, yeah, I definitely felt like Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood right now.
I'm finished. And you just throw the bowling ball and walk away. Last time I went bowling, the first ball I threw my back out.
Oh, really? No, well, that's because you throw the balls like super hard.
Yeah.
They're baseballs or something. Or softballs in this case.
Like, I didn't warm up or anything. And my back just went. So the rest of the time I was like hunched over and I had to be really careful.
You know, it took me like the longest time to figure out that, like, you know, it's not how hard you throw. It's like, it's all in the follow through, really. Yeah,
but when have you ever seen me do anything pretty or follow through in sports? Like, I just kind of bulldoze into things.
Yeah, you just kind of fall forward.
I'd be like the perfect fullback. So Mike Allstott, Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Mm, So I'm loving like the serious film question. We're not giving like a serious film answer. Yeah. I think no.
He's probably furious right now too. Like he's probably just swinging.
Has he never listened to the podcast?
He just took his Criterion Kurosawa films and just started winging them at the wall.
Yeah. Well, you know, that movie was. I know I'm getting a lot of hate for this, but it was intensely okay. If that makes any sense.
You're extremely indifferent towards it.
I mean, I recognize like how good it was, and like I recognize like how good Daniel Day-Lewis's performance was. But you know, when the credits start rolling, I'm just like, well, that's a movie that I saw. Like it didn't really affect me, you know, personally. I'm just like, I didn't go like, oh, that was like one of the best movies ever made. And I was just like, well, that was a movie. You know, it was okay. It was okay in a really intense way. You know.
Our friend Zach, he and I drove like 2 hours to go see it in Sarasota, hour and a half.
Really?
Yeah, because it wasn't playing anywhere. I loved it. I thought it was a really immersive experience, but I haven't watched it again.
Exactly. I haven't watched it again either.
It's like Lincoln. Like maybe movies where Daniel Day-Lewis like really brings like Gangs of New York. I loved it, but I just can't see myself watching it again.
Yeah, that's another movie I've only seen once. Like it was a good movie, but I'm just like, I mean, I'd rather watch Idle Hands.
And My Left Foot, too. How many times can you watch My Left Foot?
Zodiac, I've only seen once. Although, to be fair, yeah. That movie's like a million hours long. So.
I think Last of the Mohicans is a movie from Daniel Day-Lewis I could watch all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I don't think I could even watch that like more than once. I've only seen it like that one time.
That score gets me jacked up, man.
Yeah. You know what we should do? We should do a podcast about movies we've only seen once.
But we won't have much to say about them.
No, we'll just try to like remember what we like or dislike about the movie.
So what? All right, Lincoln.
Yeah.
Yeah. About Lincoln.
Daniel Day-Lewis. He was great.
I knew it was going to happen at the end.
What's her name?
Yeah. You know what I was amazed at? There was a lot of like on this. There was a lot of mud on those sets. Like so, working on those film sets. Like you, like I think working on that would be miserable because there's just mud everywhere, like all the mud streets.
Oh yeah.
Like between every take, they were probably hosing down mud.
Yeah.
You know, like the streets. So like everybody's walking through gunk.
Yeah.
It must have been annoying to work on. You know what I mean?
And you've worked on some pretty intense film sets, right?
Yeah, I've walked through like gator holes, and the guys are like, "Don't drop the camera." But okay. Like you know, you're getting out of that. If I just spend 6 months walking around in gunk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
All right, so I guess the answer to this question is Mark spent 6 months walking in a swamp.
Yeah. You know, I would have worked on The Revenant because I could have worn like a sweet like puffer jacket and just drank cocoa all day.
Yeah. But you'd be sitting around like for months at a time for like the perfect natural light.
Yeah, I mean, so you're just basically hanging out, like talking to people, drinking cocoa.
Yeah, you're maybe smoking a cigarette of Tom Hardy.
Yeah. It's like, hey, we got to get Leo ready for set. We'll just throw him in a mud puddle, you know, like, and he's ready to go.
Yeah. Hey, won him an Oscar.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you once again for those wonderful listener questions. We hope we enlighten you, maybe not in the ways you hoped, but in, you know, some other way. Yeah. All right. Mark.
Enlightened you in some other way?
Yeah. I mean, they're the listener questions.
Yeah,
they're not supposed to be straightforward.
Yeah, I don't want no yes or no's.
Right. All right, Mark. I'm also assuming you have the topic for this week.
Yeah, I do. And I was watching that trailer for The Nice Guys with Russell Crowe, Ryan Gosling. It is directed and written by Shane Black, and it got me thinking about his career as a whole, Shane Black. So basically, I've been doing a ton of research. I'm writing a really huge post just kind of about how with only 7 scripts to his name, he's only directed 2 films that have been released. So this guy has had like only 7 scripts in 30 years. You know, compare that to Wes Anderson, you know, he has about 8.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's working really slowly. Well, you know, he kind of had like an exile for a while. But this guy's, you know, his hit or miss ratio is pretty incredible. So I kind of wanted to like break down like what his films did for the film industry as a whole, because I think there's some amazing stories behind Shane Black. I mean, this is a guy, he went to UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
you know, he graduated and he wrote the script, turned in the script when he was 23 years old for Lethal Weapon. And like Lethal Weapon basically set, you know, 10 years of filmmaking up. It wasn't the first, but, you know, Lethal Weapon stars Danny Glover, Mel Gibson, was made in 87, you know, spawned three other, you know, there's four Lethal Weapon movies. It was just about two polar opposite cops. And it was amazing. You know, it balanced like pathos with like, you know, tons of violence. But there's also a great core dynamic where the characters are really important. And I just love, you know, 48 Hours did it first. But Eddie Murphy wasn't really a cop. Nick Nolte was. And it wasn't like total action. But in 87, Lethal Weapon like spawned so many, you know, it was a year before Die Hard. But then it kind of spawned like all these crazy other movies. And this guy was 23 when he wrote it. So yeah. I just think it's pretty unbelievable that this happened.
So I think, you know, for me, Lethal Weapon is like, or at least like the first two Lethal Weapon movies are some of my favorite action movies of all time. And I think what makes Lethal Weapon great, or like at least in regards to the first one, is that the relationship between Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, like their relationship kind of drives the plot, I think. Because like as they get to know each other, as they get to become more comfortable with each other, the action ramps up, you know, in correlation with like their growing relationship. And it's just like, it's like something like you don't really see too often in action movies, really. You know?
No, you're right. Like they like, you know, I watched it recently and they form a great friendship.
Yeah.
And like, I also love that it's not like, you know, at first they're kind of negative about each other, but then they grow on each other pretty quickly. And they're like kind of, you know, Danny Glover brings him into his home for dinner. And then there's this scene where they're kind of chilling on Danny Glover's boat in the driveway, just drinking beers.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I like that they, you know, one was like, you know, one guy getting ready for his retirement. Then you had another guy, you know, Mel Gibson's character, Riggs. Was it Martin Riggs? Yeah. And
Riggs and Murtaugh.
Yeah, Riggs and Murtaugh. So Martin Riggs, Roger Murtaugh. You know, Mel Gibson had Martin Riggs had lost his wife, you know, a year earlier. And people didn't know whether he was actually crazy or faking crazy to get a pension. So he ends up getting teamed up with Roger Murtaugh, who is, you know, planning retirement. And these two get into this crazy case involving drugs and death and you know, Gary Busey being a badass. He had a great run in Point Break. And then he had Under Siege, and then also Lethal Weapon. Like, he was a great secondary bad guy. Yeah. But, this movie – but I just love that it was by this 23-year-old kid. And what I find most impressive was, you know, it really changed the genre. And, like, he didn't really mean to. Everyone thought he had this unique style. But Shane Black was just kind of like, hey, guys, you know, I love the scripts for Marathon Man, Butch Cassidy, Alien, 48 Hours – these are all earlier films, and he's like, I just kind of took it from there. But what he didn't realize were all those scripts were basically groundbreaking and didn't apply to any standard rules, and they were all influential in their own way. So here's a guy, smart guy, who studies all these scripts, but these scripts he thought they were the norm. So he didn't really know any better. So he studied all these scripts that were unconventional, and then he turns in this one, and everyone's like, man, this guy's a renegade. This guy is insane. And there's a quote where he's like, well, it's not brain surgery. Like he just kind of, you know, it's definitely a hard process, but he wrote these films, you know, not expecting to change the world. And I think that's why, like with those cult classics that we were talking about earlier, that these films, that Lethal Weapon was so popular, because first and foremost, it focused on the characters. And any of the action that revolved around them was actually character driven. So you have a scene where Mel Gibson, there's a jumper about to threaten to jump off a building. Mel Gibson handcuffs himself to him and they jump. There's another scene where Danny Glover and Mel Gibson get into a firefight. Danny Glover shoots a guy in a leg just so they can have a conversation about keeping people alive. And then the guy ends up dying, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah.
But like the action scenes in this film actually further the plot and you learn about the characters. And I think a lot of movies that tried to recreate this lost the point and they just went for action first.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you talk about like Tango and Cash and everything. Like, that's when ego started getting ramped up. I didn't see much ego. Like, and what I love too is like with Glover, he was an old guy, and Mel Gibson was like perfect as like this crazy guy, but he was also likable. But there wasn't like, I guess he was like a raging drunk, but there wasn't much ego in this film, and I think that's why it worked so well.
Yeah, I think it's just, you also have to credit the amazing chemistry Mel Gibson and Danny Glover also had together. It's like they were just kind of two peas in a pod. It seems like, I don't know. I just love seeing them on screen together.
Yeah, they're buds. And Richard Donner directed it. And this is going to sound weird, but people are going to think I'm crazy. But The Goonies, I think, really influenced his filmmaking style.
Oh, really?
Because when you watch The Goonies, the way the kids talk, it's very rapid fire.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, I'm a kid, and this is the way we talk. And so I think I was watching that scene on the boat and other scenes with the two of them, and they talk over each other. It's kind of freewheeling. It's not like they're reading dialogue. It feels more natural. Donner tried it again later with that movie Timeline, and it failed miserably. But this movie, the natural style that he allowed them to do Shane Black's dialogue worked perfectly. And Shane Black's next film, The Last Boy Scout, well, he wrote Monster Squad, but his next big film, The Last Boy Scout, with Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, Halle Berry, I think the dialogue was there, but I think it got lost in kind of people reading the dialogue.
Yeah, The Last Boy Scout, like, I appreciate it. I've seen it multiple times, but, like, it just doesn't compare really well to the Lethal Weapon movies, because I think they were trying to go, like, try to recreate the same vibe from Lethal Weapon. But, like, there was just, like, there was no chemistry between Bruce Willis and, like,
Damon Wayans?
Yeah, Damon Wayans. I was about to say Marlon. I don't know. I always mix them up. There was like, just no chemistry. Like, they were just kind of, I don't know.
They were just saying dialogue back and forth to each other.
Yeah.
And, you look at, like, the buddy movie, you know, there's Tango and Cash. I think that worked. And then there's Bad Boys in 94. The last Boy Scout was 91. And, so I was watching it again, and there's some decent dialogue. Like, since we're doing a Shane Black podcast, we're going to go R-rated. Like, there's some couple scenes where he's just like, you know, this guy insults Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, and Bruce Willis is like, I'm fuckface. He's asshole. Like, it's that kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
This is the kind of movie where Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis are in a car, and a gangster walks up to him. And, this gangster guy goes, yeah, you know, something's untenable. And then Marlon Wayans is like, oh, we're dealing with the inventor of Scrabble. it's a good dialogue. And a lot of people were like saying it's kind of hacky and everything, but it's not. Like, but it didn't have. And also there was like Bruce Willis added his own thing, like with the jigs, and he did a jig dance at the end. And so a lot of that was like added in later on. So his script didn't remain pure. Actually, Shane Black said that the more he got paid for each script, the less control he had for each script.
Interesting.
Yeah, so like Lethal Weapon and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang are, I feel like, are his two best written films, and those are the films that he had control over.
Right.
So that's why, like, Last Boy Scout, I watched it when I was younger. Yeah. I think I did watch it, like, on VHS the year it came out. So I was probably, like, 10, 11. I remember I was like, this is over my head. Like, that's an intense – like, isn't the beginning that football player runs, gets a touchdown, and then murders himself?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, I mean, it's a dirty, gross, sweaty, and I think they captured the look of it well, but it never felt natural.
Well, I mean, it's a Tony Scott movie, so the cinematography is always going to look good. It's just, it's like you said, you know, if Lethal Weapon was original Coke, Last Boy Scout is Diet Coke. You know, the script's been watered down in terms of Shane Black concentrations. So
no absolutely. And it's weird, like it was watered down, but then it was very profane. It was
watered down, but in terms of like Shane Black.
No, you're right. Yeah, it was watered down. It was definitely Shane Black watered down, but like it was, but you know what I mean, like it was watered down, but it was also very profane.
Yeah.
Like they thought like, hey, swear words are cool, like, you know, after a lot of people watch Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction, there was just a lot of movies where a bunch of dudes saying dialogue swearing they thought was like the coolest thing ever. And so, but like also, so around this time, We're having movies like Collision Course with Pat Morita and Jay Leno. We're having The Hard Way with Michael J. Fox. We're getting Stop or My Mom Will Shoot in 92.
Pretty interesting time for movies.
Yeah, like another Stakeout's coming out. Red Heat was 1988 with Arnold and Belushi. All these movies, Tango and Cash is 89. 48 Hours was 82, of course. But there was also the Whoopi Goldberg dinosaur movie. And then there was you remember this movie? The gnome movie. A gnome named Normed, where a gnome teams up with it. The cops got a new partner.
I must have missed
there's
that
a lot one. Of explaining to do. So like Lethal Weapon, this script that this guy wrote totally organically spawned all these things that just tried to copy it. And so this guy wrote something, and then he had to spend a couple of years writing movies based on kind of the first movie he wrote. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes total sense, actually.
Like, people were looking at Shane Black and going, hey, Shane Black, write a Shane Black film.
Yeah.
Like, and then he's like, what? And then he also did a story for Lethal Weapon 2, which was 89. And that was actually a really good one, but he just did the story, not the screenplay. But Donner directed. So the two Lethal Weapon 1 and 2 are the best. Right. Then he did Last Boy Scout. And then came Last Action Hero, which I think is like one of the first. That was the summer that really ramped up marketing. I don't know if you remember. So The Last Action Hero is starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, one of his first flops actually ever made. He was coming off all these massive hits, and everybody thought he was untouchable. And this script comes along from this guy, Zach Penn. And it's basically about this kid who, finds movies as an escape, and he gets sucked into a movie, and he helps this guy survive, and it's like a happy little film. Well, the studio didn't like it, so they brought in Shane Black. Shane Black, added his Shane Blackiness to it, right? Then William Goldman came in, and he wrote Princess Bride, Marathon Man, great films. He got paid $1 million for 4 weeks of work to rewrite Last Action Hero.
Wow.
And then they didn't like that. So then they brought in like Carrie Fisher. They brought in other people to rewrite the script. Then they brought Shane Black back in to write it. And wow. So this is a movie directed by John McTiernan, who did Die Hard, Predator, 13th Warrior. I'll always support that movie. Great action directors, right? And then Arnold gets cast. So you had this pure script that had a great rewrite from Zach Penn, but then McTiernan made it more of an action film. Then Arnold made it more about him. Like, there was rumors about how he would drive cars around all day, seeing which ones he looked cool in. They spent days trying to find his boots. this is a movie that, if you count for inflation, it probably cost, $150 million today, which is a massive amount for movies back then.
Wow.
And this is – so – Shane Black kind of gets associated with this film, but he's not really the reason for it. But, this movie, they spent $500,000 putting their logo on a rocket that was going to shoot to space, and you can make 900 calls from it.
Oh, wow.
It put up this big balloon right after the World Trade Center bombings with Arnold Schwarzenegger holding up a stick of dynamite, and they had to cover that up. So, I think this film is one of the – and, it's going head-to-head with Jurassic Park, and everyone's like, who's going to win, Arnold or the dinosaurs? Because Spielberg's last film was Hook, and that was kind of a flop. And then, of course, Jurassic Park wiped the floor with Last Action Hero. But that kind of marketing actually, I think, paved the door for further films. Independence Day, Godzilla. Last Action Hero really amped up the marketing to another level. And that's what we're kind of seeing it today. So that's why I kind of love how these Shane Black films are always kind of starting trends, good or bad.
It's I just want to say about Last Action Hero, we were talking about cult movies earlier. And I think it's fair to classify Last Action Hero as a cult classic these days.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't do well at the box office, but I think there's a small group, which includes me, who just absolutely loved the movie. I always loved the movie. Like, I didn't watch it and hate it, but then grow to love it later on. No, I loved it from the start. it's just like a really cool concept, like a kid who just gets sucked into like his favorite movies. And it was just really cool. It's just like, this movie is just like, it's something very charming about it. I don't know. It made me feel happy.
Yeah, and the movie, kids did escape in movies. And there's some really funny things. Like, there's a police station where, the cops are getting intentionally paired with, a parallel partner that's, like, really terrible for them.
You see, like, the cartoon characters just walking around there.
Yeah, and, like, it was like Triceracop in Kung Fury. So if you had to have, like, an opposite cop that you would butt heads with, who would it be?
I feel like Riggs would be pretty fun.
Because you're a really chill guy.
Yeah. No, I think I think that would just be, like, a really fun day, just hanging out with Riggs.
Well, just, like, no, but I'm thinking, like, polar opposite, and then you have to learn to love each other.
Okay. Well, yeah.
I would hate to be teamed up with, like, a three-toed sloth that smacked gum.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's not the fact that it's just a three-toed sloth, but the fact that it just smacks his gum.
It's really slowly.
Yeah.
Like, some people do the rapid fire, but this one would be like... And it couldn't get my back.
Nope. Well, eventually. Eventually, I mean, it would.
I mean, if it had to climb something or swim.
Yeah, just tell it to climb, like, climb, like, a really tall tree. And then, like, we'll meet, like, 20 hours later.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if I'm a you know, a cop in the Redwood Forest, you know, I'm picking a sloth.
Yeah.
I just think you would annoy me. We would learn to love each other eventually, but I don't think I could take it for the first week.
Oh. Yeah, I think, you know, sloths are scary looking. You ever seen, like, a picture of a sloth?
Dude, they're tricking everybody, man. They're just trying to... They're all slow. They if they were that slow, they'd all be dead. I have no scientific theory behind this.
It's just those claws, man. Those claws are terrifying to look at. They're like velociraptor claws.
Dude, they, like, crawl around you, right, all slow, and you're like, this is adorable. Then it punctures your jugular, and you're like, clever girl.
Ugh.
But, like, yeah. It would just rip you open.
No, yeah, like you were just a plastic bag.
Yeah, like, you know how, like, it's like a Mogwai. They're all cute, you know, but they're terrible. Like, yeah. I'm telling you, man, three-toed sloths are evil. Right. But, you know, get back on the track here. But, yeah, so, you know, we have these three movies that Lethal Weapon, which inspired, you know, countless imitators, you know, it developed, like, its own style of film. And then you move on to Last Boy Scout, which I think really was one of the first, like, really – I mean, they're very profane movies, of course. But if you look, like, around the time – like, the movies weren't as, like, well, the 70s, I guess, but it was one of the more sweary, gross, intelligently dialogued film that kind of opened up before Reservoir Dogs really blew the roof off.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he did deal with some meta-commentary in Last Boy Scout. But, so, there's a line from The Last Boy Scout where he's like, this is the 90s, you got to slap somebody before you say something funny. Like, so they, like, commented, like, Shane Black was commenting on you know, something he established. And then Last Action Hero was basically meant to lampoon Lethal Weapon.
It's the circle of life.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then The Lion King came in 94, which he wrote.
Yeah. Did he write Lion King?
No.
Oh, okay.
The motherfucking circle of life.
Yeah. All right, guys. I think now's a good time to take a break. I'm going to go pop in my VHS of The Lion King. Just to make sure that I don't see Shane Black's name in the credits somewhere. But, yeah, we'll see you guys in a little bit.
When I say pod, you say...
Pie.
Wait a minute.
Whoa, what's
Robert,
going
take
on,
your,
Kyle?
Take your headphones off real quick.
Okay, sorry.
John, what the hell is this?
I don't know. Robert invited me over. And
yeah,
I don't know.
This is kind of awkward. Are we doing like a promo or something?
I don't know. I wish he'd put on his pants, though.
Yeah, he's like dancing around. He's talking about Shark Dropper.
I think he's looking for the baby oil.
Anyways, Robert, what are we doing? Huh? What are we doing?
What was that?
What are we doing?
I can put my headphones back on?
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing a promo for Shark Dropper.
Oh, okay.
That podcast we do that has improv, and we just talk about our daily lives and stuff.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
I still wish you'd find your pants.
Where can I find it?
Oh, wait. Are we supposed to wear sharkdropper.com?
Short shot time.
Welcome back to Movie Someone's Flicks. All right. So I checked, and Shane Black is nowhere in the credits for The Lion King.
What?
Just in case you guys are wondering.
Well, how about this? Jeremy Irons voiced Scar, and Jeremy Irons was in Die Hard with a Vengeance and Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis was in The Last Boy Scout, written by Shane Black.
Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah. We could do a tougher one.
Yeah.
Jonathan Taylor Thomas, right? Wasn't he the voice?
Yeah, he was the main voice of Simba.
I'm not going to do it. Yes. I'm happy with my last one.
Yeah. As well as Jonathan Taylor Thomas been in lately? Nothing.
Oh, jeez.
What up, JTT? You know where to find me.
Oh, gosh.
He shows up at the studio. I'm like, oh, man.
That'd be a great interview.
Yeah. It'd be very tense. It'd be very Shane Black-like. With a lot of... Yeah. Oh. All right. All right, I think we have another listener question.
Yeah, let's do it. So the third one is by Josh again. And this is another Paul Thomas Anderson question.
Okay.
Wait. Yeah, PTA. PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. Because there's a...
Paul W.
Let me make sure I'm getting this right. Because I don't want to get murdered by people. Paul Thomas Anderson. Because there's a couple of Paul Andersons running around.
Yeah. Paul W.S. Anderson.
I got the right one. Yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson. He's the right one.
Okay.
Okay. And then the other Paul Anderson is, let's see, let me check his name.
Made Resident Evil.
Yeah. Paul W.S. Anderson's the one who did Resident Evil.
Well, he also married Mila Jovovich. Yeah. So he's got that going for him.
I think people's heads would explode if I got the two of them wrong.
What if they were just like the same person, but he just, every time he made Resident Evil, he just switched out the initials?
Well, you got to do the studio picture to make the independent picture.
Yeah, maybe that's what he's doing.
You know, I always thought Three Musketeers was like oddly brilliant. The one with Orlando Bloom.
Yeah. That's another movie I've only ever seen once.
Dude, that big hair, he didn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So the third question is by Josh and asks, was Magnolia the first of its kind? Magnolia is a 1999 film starring Tom Cruise, Paul Thomas Anderson, William H. Macy, his whole crew. So he asks, was Magnolia the first of its kind in terms of execution and storytelling format?
Okay. So the main thing I remember for that movie is Tom Cruise going like some monologue about the vagina, right?
Yeah.
So I think in terms of Tom Cruise going on monologues about vaginas, I think the movie was definitely the first of a kind of its kind in that regards.
Yeah, because they deleted the scene in Rain Man when he had that monologue.
Yeah, I don't remember that scene in Top Gun where he was just talking about the vaginas. They didn't really talk about vaginas much in Top Gun, actually.
He and Iceman were on a motorcycle together.
Yeah.
And they were talking about it.
Maybe like that volleyball scene, like they definitely wouldn't be talking about vaginas during the volleyball scene.
Yeah, that'd be distracting.
Yeah, Days of Thunder. Man. Days of Thunder, maybe no.
I mean, that sounds like a kind of a movie. You
know, yeah, you know? I just
I'm sure there was maybe Risky Business.
Maybe. Oh, Cocktail.
Oh yeah,
there a vagina monologue in there.
I think, but you couldn't hear it because he was shaking up a martini.
Ah, true. What about, did Mission Impossible 1 come out before Magnolia?
Yes.
Okay. So
that one definitely did.
Yeah. Because there was like that scene where they were kind of trying to break into that soundproof room.
Yeah. Right?
What if the camera was outside when he was inside the soundproof room, but he had like he was talking about the vaginas the whole time?
Yeah. And we never would have known.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I still think Magnolia is the first of its kind. Really?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this, and, you know, it's not the first of its kind because, you know, it revolves around multiple stories that take place in L.A. and how they kind of intertwine with each other. And that's reminded me of Robert Altman's Shortcuts.
Right.
Because it also was like about a group of interlinked Los Angeles stories. You know?
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. I think it's a newer type film, but I don't think it's a true original because it has, like, the interlocking series of episodes in L.A. Shortcuts did that. He was also kind of riding off the coattails of, you know, Spike Jones from Being John Malkovich.
Right.
Oh man, some people's heads are exploding. I think it's a brilliant film, but I think that it tells a story that hasn't been told before, but similar ones have been made, like Shortcuts.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I like my answer better.
I mean, I think Surf Ninjas is a true original.
Yeah, it was. That was groundbreaking.
I mean, when have there been surf ninjas? And Leslie Nielsen is a samurai.
Yeah. I've never seen it before. Before that movie came along.
What are some other ones? Like 2001, I think. Being John Malkovich, maybe. Blair Witch Project.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah. One. Eraserhead, right? Eraserhead?
Yeah. The, yeah.
Groundhog Day?
Actually, I think you might be right about that one.
Right. What about, like, The Great Dictator by Charlie Chaplin? Well, people really had been making that many films. What, Night of the Living Dead? They had done zombies before, but they were voodoo. So right. This is kind of... Or what about Memento?
Oh, yeah, where, like, the story is told backwards.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, I don't think... has there ever been a movie that told its story backwards like that?
I mean, I've watched WrestleMania backwards, but...
Mm.
A Hulkamania. That was an Ernest Scared Stupid line. I don't think there has. Oh, no. I was going to say Irreversible, but that came afterwards. Like Pink Flamingos by John Waters. I read his book. It's really good, by the way. Slacker, right?
Yeah.
Because that kind of started Clerks. Toy Story?
Yeah. Well, Toy Story was like one of the first... I could be completely wrong about this. Was one of the first CG movies? Completely CG movies?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's like a terrible movie that's a total original? Birdemic? No.
Yeah.
Mummy 3?
Yeah. Mummy 3 was the first of its kind.
Yeah. All right. So let's say Mummy 3. The answer is Mummy 3.
Yeah. Awesome. Yetis. That's the answer to that question.
I say for our next podcast, I just read off lists.
I think I'll be down for that.
Call it BuzzFeed.
Yeah. BuzzFeed, the podcast.
Muzzfeed. Oh, brother.
All right, Mark. Yeah. Got more Shane Black?
Yeah, absolutely. The next film is like groundbreaking for all the wrong reasons. Because if you count inflation, Shane Black got paid $6.4 million. To turn in this script, which was The Long Kiss Goodnight, about an amnesia, Gina Davis. She's a super spy, but she has amnesia. She has a family, but then she gets her head back, and then her and Samuel Jackson murder a lot of people. But basically the only reason this movie's remembered is because he got paid, at the time, $4 million to write the script. So, like, remember when Jim Carrey got paid $20 million for Cable Guy, and then everyone hated it?
Yeah.
Like, I think this is one of those cases where the buzz just got so big. And then this was – so Gina Davis and her husband, Rennie Harlan, who also directed Deep Blue Sea and Cliffhanger, this was their follow-up to Cutthroat Island, which is one of the biggest flops of all time. So, I mean, the movie was kind of bound to fail. But since then, it's become a cult classic. They've talked sequels, TV shows, et cetera. People kind of love it now. But at the time, he was known for writing a script that was – that he got, you know, $4 million for. The director of Deadpool, Tim Miller, he got $250,000 to direct that film. You know, there's back end, of course. Yeah. But, I mean, that's ridiculous when you think of a guy who wrote it. Well, I guess Deadpool said they're the true talents. But, I mean, that was a time there in the 90s, like around, let's see, 96, where, like, that was basically the last of those kind of movies. Because if you think like 94, The Specialist, there was like a showdown in Little Tokyo with Dolph Lundgren. This was kind of the end of that age of like incredibly bloody movies like this style. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like it was the perfect hate storm brought down upon this guy at like the perfect moment. So everything converged to kind of shit on him.
Yeah. So because he got paid so much, does that mean he didn't really have a lot of control over the – what the script looked like in the final version?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this got changed, you know, completely. Not completely, but it definitely got changed big time. You know, Rennie Harlan kind of took it over. And Rennie Harlan is not if you think about his movies, he's not like a master of subtlety or like dialogue.
Yeah.
Actually, actors love working with him, but, he's more like he's more like explosions in your face. Like, you know, he did have that great moment with Sam Jackson in Deep Blue Sea, one of the greatest deaths of all time. But his movies are just so blunt. So you have this somewhat stylized dialogue meeting like this. This, you know, is English, you know, Rennie Harlan, his English wasn't too great because, you know, he was a Swede. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like a weird gap between them. So this movie was good. And I think people liked it. You know, it's positive on Rotten Tomatoes. Ebert liked it. But audiences just wanted to, like, punch it in the face before it came out.
It, yeah. I mean, I honestly don't remember this movie. I know I've seen it. But it was just, like, it was just so unforgettable. You know, I mean, I know it's totally forgettable.
It's really unforgettable, but I don't remember anything. Just worth it. Well, like, you know, there's scenes, though, that happen now in movies that are in this film, like Gina Davis and Sam Jackson jump from a third story building and she shoots the ground below them and they fall through. You know, that's been done in movies before, like in Underworld and everything like that. Like, mm-hmm. Gina Davis was one of the first, like, you know, obviously there was Linda Hamilton. There were very tough, you know, Sigourney Weaver, you know, in many martial arts films. There were really tough women. But this was kind of interesting because Shane Black's script didn't want to treat her as, like, a tough woman. Like, he was like, you know, he just wanted to treat this as a tough character that happened to be a woman. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So she's, like, protective of her family, but she's not like, oh, you know, my nails. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying women are like that, but a lot of roles, you know, if think about Jurassic World, you know, she's running around in heels and it's kind of like a joke. This movie was like, Gina Davis was a legit badass in this movie. And so I think that actually opened the door for future roles, because eventually Laura Croft came around, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. You know, I think roles kind of started to evolve a little bit. I'm not saying The Long Kiss Goodnight did this, but it is now a cult classic. And they were talking sequels around Iron Man 3 time. So, you know, this is one of those movies where if you catch it, I mean, I recommend watching it. Like, it's really dark and bloody and a lot of civilians get murdered. But, I mean, it's like a weird hybrid of a really good script meets a really loud director. And I think it sort of almost killed off that kind of auteur vibe for a while, like action auteur vibe, because this is kind of more like the reign of like Michael Bay coming in, who preferred kind of style over substance, mm-hmm. whereas Shane Black always preferred, you know, substance with style.
So what you're saying is that Rennie Harlan, like, he'll try to make Michelangelo's David with a jackhammer, but he'll try to get as close as possible. Whereas Michael Bay will just try to blow up Michelangelo's David.
yeah, he won't even try to make it. He'll just be screaming at people. And it'll be a 2.5-hour incredibly slow-mo explosion of David.
I'd watch it.
Yeah, like, it's just, and I don't know. I think there's a reason why his movies have become such cult classics, like this movie has, is because, you know, it did okay, but people really didn't, I don't know. I think quality, even when Shane Black doesn't have, it's not an initial hit, I think people realize it later. But this movie actually forced him into a really long hiatus. And the movie he came out with next, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in 2005, is, I think, one of the best written films of the 2000s. It actually, you know, Robert Downey Jr. was sleeping in other people's beds. He was a drunk. He was in a lot of trouble. But Shane Black hired him.
Yeah.
And brought him on for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And it's because of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang that Robert Downey Jr. got Iron Man. And then in Iron Man 3, Robert Downey Jr. had Shane Black write and direct Iron Man 3. And that movie made over $1 billion worldwide.
So he knows what he's doing.
Yeah. But I just love how, like, you know, he helped out Robert Downey Jr. Then Robert Downey Jr. helped out Shane Black. Because after Long Kiss Goodnight, nobody would work with Shane Black. And he went to Joel Silver, Uber producer who did the Lethal Weapon movies, Last Boy Scout. And Joel Silver's like, listen, I'll give you $15 million and you can make this movie. So he cast Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer, Michelle Monaghan, who I don't think have been better in years. I mean, have you watched? I mean, just the dialogue in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is just pure gold. And if you a lot of Shane Black films have private detectives, cops, et cetera, et cetera. But this is like just a caper. It's like a Dashiell Hammett crime novel. You know, it's like it's just pulp at its very best. And no, I just loved it. I watched it again the other night, and I think it's one of, you know, the better movies of the 2000s. But I just love it because, you know, it only made $4 million in the movie theaters, which is nothing.
No.
But because of this movie, it really influenced Marvel, you know?
Well, in terms of casting Robert Downey Jr.?
Yeah, because everyone loved him. And once again, people love Iron Man because they love the character, and they could care less about the CGI baddies.
So I think, first off, I want to mention Shane Black actually also directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He didn't just write it, which is just like another big step. But the thing I remember most about this movie is that I just love Robert Downey Jr.'s, you know, charisma. Like, it's just like oozing out of every scene in this movie. Like, he always has like the wittiest thing to say, like his repartee with Val Kilmer. Like, it's always like really sharp. And it's just like Robert Downey Jr. is like pure Robert Downey Jr. in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah.
You know?
And I love his character because he's kind of dumb.
Yeah.
And Val Kilmer's character, his name is Gay Perry. It's like Gay Perry. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Val Kilmer plays, you know, Gay Perry. And he teams up with Harry, who's like, and the movie is about this criminal who sneaks into this audition because he's being chased by the cops. And he gives this great audition, and he gets shipped to L.A. and hooked up with a private detective played by Val Kilmer to kind of get some experience for the role.
Yeah.
So, like, here's some dialogue. They just had this big fight. And Perry, Val Kilmer, goes to Harry, goes, "Go, sleep badly. Any questions? Hesitate to call." And then Harry goes, "Bad." And Val Kilmer goes, "Excuse me?" And then Harry's like, "Sleep bad, otherwise it makes it seem like the mechanism that allows you to sleep." And then Gay Perry goes, "What, fuckhead? Who taught you grammar? Badly's an adverb. Get out. Vanish." Like, this is a movie. Like, it's funny. Like, it's just they're talking about, like, because earlier in the movie, Downey had been corrected for his speech. And then he tried to do it to Val Kilmer, and he was totally wrong. And once again, like he said, this movie was probably, like, the best experience of his career. So he said in an interview with the AV Club, Shane Black, he said, "I'm more proud of it than anything else I've done. It's effectively what I wanted. So if this movie's bad, it's my fault. It's not somebody else who changed or censored or edited it. This is the stuff I wanted, and that's what's on screen. And if you don't like it, it's my bad."
Wow.
So, and then I love what they wrote later. They wrote on this article, they're saying, "Watching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang prompts wishes that Hollywood still had screenwriters talented enough to use explosion-filled trash as a means for personal expression. More improbably, it also prompts nostalgia for the glory days of the buddy comedy, Lethal Weapon, which can really zing when the right actors bounce the right dialogue off each other." So the two movies that he did were like perfect buddy comedies. So when you look in, like, the pantheon of buddy comedy, Shane Black has two of the best because they were his.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I remember watching this movie. Like, I didn't know anything about it going in. And, like, when I found out later on that the guy who wrote Lethal Weapon also wrote this movie, it just made perfect sense because, like, the chemistry that was present between Mel Gibson and Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon was also present in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Like, it felt like these two had known each other for years, even though they just were still kind of strangers, you know, with the way they were just, like, comfortable with just talking with each other, you know?
Yeah, and, like, Val Kilmer has, I don't think he's been better in years. And this is a funny story. I was doing a Comic-Con in Ohio, and one of my buddies, Dave, he's a total fanboy, and he walked up to Val Kilmer and was like, "Man," he's like, "you were hilarious in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang." And Kilmer goes, "I was. Wasn't I?" And then Dave had to carry his luggage.
Oh, man.
But that was the only thing he said to him. "I was. Wasn't I?"
It sounds like something Gay Perry would say.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he was doing that.
Oh.
Yeah, so that was, you know, I don't know. But so then that happened. Then Iron Man 3. We talked about it a lot in our Marvel villain podcast. But what I love about Iron Man 3 is it really foregoed a lot of the people in CGI suits killing each other. There's, like, action scenes where Downey Jr. only has, like, Tony Stark only has, like, a hand and a leg.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at the end, he's switching out of suits because they keep busting down. So Shane Black understood that people love the character. And so that's why I love it. And also, like, if you think about him messing with a convention and having fun, he took one of the most iconic bad guys and made him like a British homeless guy who was addicted to drugs and took really smelly craps. Like in the film Iron Man 3, there's this bad, he's a really bad guy, but it just turns out they hired an actor to portray this character, the Mandarin. But the movie, you know, made $1 billion, and it's just Iron Man 3. It's not the Avengers. It's not that. I mean, when all said and done, it's probably going to make more than Batman versus Superman. And I think the strength of that is just the way, you know, people love the character. And so I think Shane Black really keyed in on that. I think he's just a master of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then his next film, The Nice Guys, if you watch the trailer, it's like a bunch of jokes while people get murdered terribly. So I think Shane Black is like back. It looks like Lethal Weapon met Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and spawned like a child.
Yeah. You know, I just, you know, taking it back to Iron Man 3,
yeah,
like, you remember the kid that he, that Tony Stark, like, kind of interacted with, like, when he was kind of, quote-unquote, broken down? Or like the suit was broken down. Like, I felt like there was some like a witty dialogue between those two. I'm just like, is this kid Val Kilmer to Tony Stark right now?
Yeah, there's like a scene where like Downey Jr. is like, how many of those like Skittles have you eaten? The kid's like, I've eaten 2 jars. Like, and then the little kid tries to fake him out with like a sad face.
Yeah.
And like, he never takes it easy on the little kid. Like, it's, yeah, they're like, it was a buddy comedy between a little kid and Downey Jr.
Yeah, it felt like a really weird aside, but if you remember, like, well, it's a Shane Black movie, I'm like, oh, well, that kind of makes sense, you know?
Yeah, and of course they all take place during Christmas as well.
You know, I'm really glad that Iron Man 3 was better than Iron Man 2, because Iron Man 2 just felt completely flat to me. It was just kind of meh.
And if you look at it, it basically follows the rule of sequels. It just got bigger, dumber, more expensive. And I know at the end of Iron Man 3, there's a lot of villains, but I think Iron Man 3 took it back to the character a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Iron Man 2 had Justin Hammer, Mickey Rourke. It introduced Scarlett Johansson. Then it brought in Samuel Jackson. And then there was just so much more to it.
Yeah.
Whereas Iron Man 3 was just... it was just, you know, a few. I know there's more to it, absolutely, but there's like a massive scene where it's just him and a kid chilling in a town talking smack to each other.
So let's speculate wildly for a little bit. That's something we usually never do here on Movies, Films, and Flicks. But yeah, so maybe Robert Downey Jr. saw the results of Iron Man 2, and he recognized that the problem was that they kind of took the focus away from Tony Stark. So he thought, like, well, maybe how can I, you know, get the focus back on track, get the focus back on Tony Stark. Like, who would be the guy for the job? Like, what guy in Hollywood, like, could just focus on this one character and make a great action movie out of it? And it's just like, you have to imagine Shane Black was like the only person on that list, right?
Yeah, and he can handle action well too, and humor. Remember that scene where Robert Downey Jr. sticks his blaster at that henchman, and the guy's like, I quit. I don't even like this place. These guys are weird. And the henchman runs away. Like, that's what we had our podcast about henchmen. And that's what every henchman should do. He's like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Like, I quit. Just like, you know, he kind of did what Joss Whedon did with the Avengers. James Gunn did with Guardians of the Galaxy. He just added humor and it was fun. He added some fun to the proceedings, but the action was also great. You know, not great, but the action was fun. Actually, you don't really need great action in an Iron Man movie. But once again, like, it was just a funny little film.
Yeah. So.
And you want to hear something random?
Yeah.
Shane Black acted in Predator. He was in the movie Oh my gosh. This is going to. Remember, what were we talking about earlier about Tom Cruise? Oh, the monologue?
Yeah, the vagina monologues.
Well, remember the joke that Shane Black tells in Predator?
No.
Well, he says that it's kind of gross, but he speaks into a woman's vagina and then there's an echo. Hello.
Okay.
that really brings us back. Wow. All right, but Shane Black was in Predator in 87. Now he's going to direct the big budget reboot to make it good again after all the crappy Predator films.
So is there going to be like a a scene where the Predator is just like having like witty repartee?
They're just broing out.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson and the Predator are just chilling in a tree drinking beer.
Yeah. You know, I'm actually really excited for that. I want to see a character-driven Predator movie.
But like, if you think about the first one, you remember, like, or I don't know if you remember all their names, but you look at all those characters that were in the jungle as characters.
Yeah,
you know, like, you can picture all of them clearly in your head, and I think you can almost visualize how all of them died. But when you think back at a lot of action films, you can't remember how or where who these people are. Like in Aliens did the same thing too. You remember the characters' names,
right?
So I think Shane Black's going to bring that back to the Predator.
I just want to see I just want to see what kind of Shane Black things he kind of puts in the in the movie.
Well, it's going to take place during Christmas.
Yeah, obviously.
It's going to be about a private detective.
Yeah. Whose job is what?
Danny Glover was in Predator 2.
Oh yeah. Oh man.
We're just
blowing minds here, actually.
I think my other neighbor's head just exploded.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's going to be a character-driven Christmas film with a lot of blood and humor.
You know, I'm actually...
So,
his other movie you mentioned that's coming out soon, The Nice Guys, with the Goss and Russell Crowe. That looks really good. That looks really good. It looks like another pure Shane Black type of movie. You know, because there's like some good dialogue in the trailer between those two.
Yeah, and people are dying too. Like, you're watching that movie and people are falling and getting shot and getting murdered, and then they're kind of funny about it. Like, he finds a way to really, like,
one scene in the trailer where like Ryan Gosling punches the window and he just like, oh no, like he cuts his arm on the glass. It was like, oh,
yeah,
this
that's
is
a lot of blood.
Oh man.
Like, there's always beats like that though in his films, like in Lethal Weapon, Mel Gibson does like the Three Stooges stuff. You know, there's like the funny like the random dialogue, the C4 usage in Last Boy Scout. Like, there's a lot of weird humor in his movies revolving blood, and getting hurt.
Yeah, I'm really excited. It's coming out like during the summer season, which is kind of weird, but maybe it's like counter programming or something.
I think that might work.
Yeah, I'm gonna watch it.
I'm not excited for any of these summer movies.
Not even Civil War.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be amazing.
Yeah. All right.
What about all the other ones?
I think that's it. Right.
Yeah.
Keanu. Key and Peele's movie.
Oh yeah. It's gonna be adorable.
It's gonna be a weird movie. I'm gonna watch it.
That features everything I love. Key and Peele, cats, and Keanu.
Yeah. All right. I think that does it for Shane Black. At the moment, he's got more stuff coming out, thankfully.
Yeah.
I think, we're all better for having Shane Black in our lives. That's my final thought.
Seven films from like almost 30 years. Yeah. And he really left, you know, a big presence in Hollywood. I mean, name somebody else who made only seven films. I'm sure somebody can.
Like, exactly, but, seven films?
Like, he's, you know, written seven films that has made as much of like a splash in Hollywood.
Yeah. I mean, he's no Woody Allen. That's for sure.
Yeah, he's not churning them out.
I think during time, like, this podcast was recorded, Woody Allen made three movies.
And they all starred, like, Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we wrap up, are there any plugs you want to make, Mark?
You know, a big shout-out to Shark Dropper. Listen to all their podcasts. Subscribe to Movies, Films, and Flicks on iTunes. We're on Blog Talk Radio. Hello, Blog Talk Radio. Also, hello to The Lamb, the large-ass movie blog association. Or wait, that'd be The Llama. The Large Association of Movie Blogs. What up, everybody?
Yeah.
Head to The Lamb. Check out there. It's basically a big grouping of movie sites. And also, watch Deep Blue Sea.
Well, that's something that
twice.
That's something that should go unsaid, because you should already be watching Deep Blue Sea twice.
I think, yeah, you have one earbud in.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's always like playing in your ear somewhere. I think, shout out to.
I got blanked there because I was watching it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, shout out to The Last Action Hero for being an awesome movie. Really. You should go watch it if you've never seen it.
Actually. And Triceracop.
Yes. And obviously check out all the Shane Black movies we mentioned, you know. Because without Shane Black, this podcast would not have been possible. So thank you, Shane Black. All right.
Wait, this podcast in general or this episode?
Both.
Isn't that how you and I started? We were watching a bad movie, and I was like, hey, man, we should do a Shane Black podcast.
Well, we were usually watching a bad movie.
So. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. All right.
So it might have been.
Yeah. I don't know. Or you might have been passed out from the Coors
Light.
From all the Coors Light you drink. You drank a lot of Coors Light back in the day, actually.
I was a maniac.
Yeah. It was like your favorite drink ever, Coors Light.
I thought it was like water. I thought it was cool. I would like walk in, I would order a shot of Jack Daniels,
yeah.
I would chug it,
uh-huh.
And then I'd just drink a boatload of Coors Light. I was working in a bar, and when they didn't have Coors Light, I'd go to the gas station, buy Coors Light, bring it back to the bar. I was such an idiot. Oh, gosh.
Well, although, in your defense, Coors Light is pretty refreshing. So,
yeah.
Hey, shout out to Coors Light. Yeah,
according to the brewskis, Coors Light is all right, but it tastes like any other light, you know, but it's still all right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Nope.
It's better than Miller Light.
All right, guys, for my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
See you guys.
I've been your host, John Lossoff. John Lovegood will be back with us next week, probably 30 pounds heavier. yeah. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.